Welcome to the WeatherPod, a podcast about the growing importance of weather information to business and society. I'm Alan Thorpe. I'm a former Director General of the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts, a former head of the UK Met Office's Hadley Centre, and a professor of meteorology.
And I'm David Rogers. I'm a former chief executive of the UK Met Office and am now a consultant with the World Bank, helping countries improve their weather-related disaster management systems and services.
Weather information is a critical international resource for saving lives, making business and society more efficient, and building resilience to extreme weather and climate change.
In each episode, we invite a leading expert to discuss how public, private, and academic sectors work together to produce weather information and make it available to business and society.
We also investigate how weather-affected public and private enterprises actually use it and the new business opportunities being created.
And because extreme weather often impacts the poorest the hardest, we'll look beyond the rich countries to the less developed ones, which host most of the world's population.
In this episode of the WeatherPod, we will be discussing prospects for growing Africa's science capability for weather prediction. We're delighted to have two guests in the studio today who have considerable experience both in scientific research on tropical weather systems and in operational weather forecasting in Africa. Professor Doug Parker from the University of Leeds, United Kingdom, and Dr. Marianne Diop-Kane from the WMO Africa Regional Office, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Both Doug and Marianne have distinguished careers in this field, and recently they have been working together on the African SWIFT project, which we will discuss in the podcast today. Their collaboration has included producing a unique textbook on weather forecasting in West Africa called Meteorology of Tropical West Africa, The Forecaster's Handbook. It collects together the scientific principles and practical forecasting techniques for that climatic region. Welcome, Marianne and Doug, to the WeatherPod.
Yes, it's great to have you both as our guests today.
Thanks for inviting us.
It's a pleasure to be able to join you from Addis Ababa.
Let's open with a look at the African SWIFT project. This started in 2017, and it's carrying out research and capability building aimed at delivering improved weather forecasts and a stronger research community to help sustain those improvements. SWIFT builds upon long-standing partnerships between African and European investigators. So, Doug, I wonder, what were the main challenges that the project faced in building these research partnerships?
As you mentioned, Alan, we have had an advantage in putting SWIFT together in that we have long-standing relationships with most of the key partners in the project. So, Marianne and I have worked together for a number of years, and we have worked with the other partners too. In the most part, there are one or two organisations that we brought in new to the project, but mostly we've worked together. So we had this advantage. I think in that situation, then the real challenge has been to bring in new people. So we've had a particular emphasis on encouraging early career scientists and early career forecasters in the project. So in fact, this is one of the great pleasures of a project like this, is seeing new faces come in, the younger members of the group, and encouraging them, giving them opportunity to take some leadership in the project, and seeing them grow their skills. And over the period of 4 years, faces start to emerge from the large project and people start to show their abilities. It is hard for early career scientists to break into this kind of international collaborative research, to come into this blind. So I think it's very important that we make use of all the projects that come and go. And in those projects, we don't just support the established scientists, but we mentor and encourage the younger scientists to come forward.
How did you identify the new participants, the early career participants? How did you find them?
Well, mostly they come in through the partner organisations. So we tend to know the more senior people in the organisation, and then they bring in new partners. But we also have programmes for fellowships. So we're supporting independent fellowships which have been open for application. We've particularly encouraged female applicants for those. So we're pleased that nearly 50% of our fellows are female.
Marianne, viewed from the African side of the partnerships, I wondered how have you gone about addressing these challenges in practice? And in particular, how has that worked out in terms of coping with these partnerships during the pandemic?
As Doug said, I've been working with him for a very long time. But setting this project is kind of new between National Med Services and universities. So it was quite difficult somehow because we are working through the administrative procedures, working from a different environment. It was quite different from our operating procedures. So setting up the project in the beginning between the National Med Service and the University of Leeds and other partners was quite difficult. And we had to fill those long diligence questionnaires, getting financial input from National Med Services. That was difficult, honestly, but we managed to sort it out. Also getting the staff involved in the project, buy in the project and work towards the deliverables was not very easy, because they felt it as an extra workload they had to do on top of their forecasting duties. But in the end, I think that we managed something. But in terms of the pandemics, I think it's even more difficult with the lockdown and the social distancing, especially when they had to organize those test beds. But I think Doug may be able to say more about it, because you may know that I've already left the Met office before the pandemic, so I wouldn't be able to comment further.
Doug, do you have a view on that?
Yes, the pandemic, as many people around the world have noticed, it's had a negative impact on our work. There's some things we've struggled to do, but there have been some positive sides. I think, you know, as you're aware, that the weather services are a vital part of national activities and risk reduction. So throughout the pandemic, our colleagues in the weather services have been going to the office and delivering their forecasts as they need to do to protect their populations. But in the universities, people have been forced to work from home and don't necessarily always have the communications facilities that they need to do their work. But having worked through that, we actually now are in a position where we've learned a lot about remote learning. And I think for international cooperation across Africa and between Africa and the global north, we've probably learned a few things about communication that will stand us well in the future.
Doug, I'm particularly interested in understanding how scientific research advances can lead to improvements in forecasting extreme weather in sub-Saharan Africa. What needs to be done globally and what needs to be done in the continent?
Well, I'm really, you've got me onto my favourite topic here. I really feel that we are on the verge of enormous improvements in weather forecasting in Africa. I think it's not quite here, but it's just around the corner with a small extra push. I think it's worth saying first that people often make an assumption that because we have extremely good numerical weather prediction in the mid-latitudes in Europe and in the USA, that the same is true globally. And it really isn't true. The forecasts in Africa, say for one day, 24-hour rainfall, are extremely poor by objective verification. There was a paper published recently that showed that the one-day forecast from the European Centre Ensemble was no better than climatology. So almost useless. However, we're on the verge of massive improvements, particularly with new computer power bringing high-resolution convection-permitting simulations. And lots of studies have been showing how these really transform the way that we model the water cycle and extreme rain in particular. So this is a major possibility for improved numerical weather prediction. Another area of massive potential is in nowcasting, where given that we may not be confident in the forecast today, we really, really need to know the current situation today. We need to have a picture of extreme weather now, and nowcasting is what delivers that. And satellite nowcasting has been around for Africa for at least 10 years, but it's barely been implemented because of the technological challenges. The technological hurdles are not enormous, but they do need to be overcome. So in the SWIFT project, this has been one of our major focuses of activity, is to get the satellite nowcasting systems working. And we've done that first in the UK, and now we're transferring the technology and the know-how to Africa. So our African partners now are able to access the products locally. We've been working with forecasters to become familiar with these nowcasting products. And we're working to actually make these available through mobile phones, through smartphones. So all this kind of work is ongoing, and it's not trivial. We can see that over the next 5 years, there will be a real transformation in the quality and the accuracy of the information which is the scientists and operational centres are able to provide. And then the challenge will be to effectively communicate to people in the way they need it.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
Marion, from what Doug said, it's obviously it would be highly beneficial if there's more capacity in the meteorological community in Africa, both in academic public sectors and probably in the private sector. Could you outline your thoughts on how this could be done and how we could actually improve the situation for the academic research community in Africa?
You are right. We need to strengthen capacity development in Africa. And this has to be done both for human and infrastructure. I think that the academic research community needs to be aware of those research advances, have easy access to the peer review journals. Collaboration between the developed and underdeveloped research community need to be strengthened and have ways of sharing papers. The SWIFT project has already been very good in that, as they were posting some research papers of interest so that the underdeveloped researchers can have access on that. And I would suggest also having training programs and exchange of staff. This would be, I think, beneficial for both communities. Putting up some short-term training courses on the latest development, but have some facility of payments of the tuition fees, because this can be an issue in Africa. I can give the example of the ECMWF short courses they were running. They were very interesting on numerical weather prediction, data assimilation, and even just on their products. But transferring the money or paying by card can be an issue for national health services in Africa. So I would suggest including these kind of courses in projects. And I think that SWIFT did it even in the beginning, if I remember well, Doug, and this is really beneficial. So in terms of infrastructure for the research, I think that this needs to be improved. Researchers need good computers, HPCs even sometimes, and good internet access, and especially good IT support. In NWP, many national health services are running models at resolution even lower than what the global centers are doing now. And the question becomes, is it worth it? And some may not carry on research in that sense because we're not doing any better than the global centers. But I think it's still worth it, but you will develop the expertise and get the African scientists in the in research, trying to understand the convective parameterization and so on, and improve the forecasting at the local level. And I would say to Doug in the beginning that he was saying that the weather forecast, even 24-hour rainfall is still poor, but I think that it has improved really a lot. From people who have been in the ground in Africa, forecasts have improved a lot. And you just don't take the output of the numerical model as granted. You use your own experience and make something out of it.
It's notable from the maps of the available observations required for global and actually regional weather prediction that there's a significant paucity of many categories of observations in Africa. both for model initialization and also for forecast evaluation. To me, this seems a bit surprising given the revolution in satellite Earth observation. So I wonder, Doug, what's your perspective on this issue and how do you think it could be best addressed?
So I think that, you know, we have a lot of coverage of satellite data now, which has made a massive impact globally on the quality of global forecasts. But we still do need in-situ data, particularly for low-level thermodynamics, temperature and humidity at low levels. And the tropics, of course, are dominated by convection. And to get convection right, you need to get really accurate thermodynamics. The in-situ data is still vital, and upper air data from balloon soundings is still vital, and a number of studies have shown how much we need this. So the satellites have made a big impact, but don't solve everything, and particularly on the smaller scale. I think there are a lot of challenges. I mean, I can talk more about the challenges of the observational networks in Africa. You know, I had some experience of this from the AMA project, where we invested in the operational upper air radiosonde network very successfully. And we did that through close cooperation with the agencies responsible for the soundings. And that had a sustained impact on the quality of the observing network. I think what was most important in that process was the management of the overall program, the need for a close connection between monitoring the performance of the network and the delivery of solutions when things go wrong, because things commonly go wrong. So that kind of management, and particularly management of funding, was really vital. I know that the WMO has a number of initiatives going at the moment to try to get more sustainable funding into observing networks, and I certainly support that kind of mentality, to have a traceable funding line between successful delivery of observations. But I think another sort of aspect of this is also kind of the meteorological environment of observations. And so observations are also needed because they create local ownership of the meteorological process. And there's a connection which needs to be maintained between the observation and the use of the observation. So I think one of the reasons for the decline in observations is that they've started to have a secondary role in the local forecasting activity, with the numerical weather prediction having a more significant role, and failing to close the loop whereby the observation through assimilation into the model improves the model. So I maybe explain that in a roundabout way, but I think the connection between the observation which is made by a weather service and the quality of the numerical weather prediction which comes from the European Centre or from somewhere remote is not being properly made. So this is one area where I think that the local African centres, or some of them, running their own numerical weather prediction models could be very important in creating the environment where there's a real driver for having local observations, because agencies know they need the local observations to feed their local weather prediction system. So it's a long-standing problem, the observing network in Africa, and there have always been programs to try and fix this, and there remain problems. I think there are some positive moves at the moment. So as I say, the local use of numerical weather prediction, the local running of numerical weather prediction models is a good thing. Another thing is that the WMO has a coordination framework called WIGOS, whereby there's a local agency, and I believe the African one is being set up in Dakar, but there's a local, the WIGOS office will monitor the performance of observing networks in real time, and it will have some resources, some funding to provide solutions when things go wrong. So this kind of real-time monitoring of performance and dealing with problems this is the management aspect which I started talking about, which is really vital.
There's always a financial trade-off, and we're looking at the affordability of networks, and we're looking at the affordability of national meteorological services. So there's a trade-off between what you do, whether you observe or whether you model. I mean, there are actually real trade-offs if you're actually going to be a Met service that's trying to do both. And I would wonder, when you answered the question about, there should be local modelling, yes, perhaps as a centre representing multiple countries, but from an individual country point of view, there's a huge distraction in terms of the affordability of what is actually quite expensive computing resources, even for relatively modest models, and the cost of running an observing network, where it's roughly 50 to 60% of the operating budget of the Met Service. Could you just comment on that?
Well, I agree with that essential point. I wouldn't for a minute argue that every one of the African nations should be running numerical weather prediction. It is a big investment. Mm-hmm. But certainly not all weather services in Europe have the same capability in numerical weather prediction. We don't all need to be running big global models. And in Africa, there are some centers now that clearly have capability and are running models. And this then becomes a driver for the whole meteorological chain to be sustained more strongly. I think another point, though, it's good that you raised the funding because there are lots of reports that say we should have better observations, but not necessarily arguing how to achieve that. I think what was really dramatic that we learned in the AMA project was that the networks which are running effectively in the upper air radiosonde network over Africa are primarily the ASECNA network in tropical Africa. So ASECNA is the aviation security network, largely in the Francophone countries. And it's an international agency. Its responsibility is aircraft security, but part of that responsibility is to have the airport observations, including the radio sondes. Now, ASECNA receives its funding directly from the fees that airlines and passengers pay. And therefore, there's a transparent connection between the income that ASECNA receives and the observation that it makes, that's sort of contractually maintained. In other places, in other countries, the funding from aviation disappears into the government and only gets filtered back to the weather service imperfectly. So the weather service is underfunded. When you talk to directors of weather services, they say we can't run radio sondes, they're very expensive. It costs us, $1,000 a week to launch sondes, and we don't have that money. But if money is coming transparently from aviation, and aviation clearly needs these services, then those costs are not unsupportable. So it's about the correct and appropriate deployment of the money which exists.
I wonder, Marianne, if you would have a view on this as an ex-director of a Met Service in Africa, about this issue of the division of resources to either modelling or the observational network and the funding, perhaps. I wonder if you had a view on that, Marianne?
I quite agree that all national Met Services don't need to go onto modelling. So those which are better off can afford it. And especially you can set up those modeling centers within the regional specialized meteorological centers that are supposed to be giving support to their neighbors. So you can set it up like in Dakar, they're doing so. And they also running the SWFDP, Severe Weather Forecasting Demonstration Project, and are supposed to give products to their neighbors within their region. Like in Kenya, they're doing it, Tanzania, and South Africa. So we need really to make a balance between between putting funds in the observation or in the modeling. And as Doug said, WMO is looking at sustaining the observation through the surface systematic observing facility fund to make sure that we have enough observation to run the NWP, that Africa get back the returns as well in their forecasting products.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
It's a huge step between advancing our understanding of atmospheric science and increasing the resilience of society to extreme weather events. Much depends on transitioning scientific know-how into operations, and this is universally challenging. Marianne, from your perspective as the next director of the Senegalese Weather Service, what can be done to improve the uptake of scientific advances?
This is a universal challenge, and it may be worse in the developing world. The issue is twofold. First, translating the research into operations. Forecasters need to be aware of new techniques and tools, accept them, be convinced of their usefulness before they are willing to apply them. Second, the delivery and use of the forecasts and warnings need to be improved. These forecasts and warnings need to be timely and effectively delivered to the users, either decision makers or local users, and be efficiently used in order to increase the resilience of society to extreme weather events. I think that this last mile must understand the information they are receiving, together with the associated uncertainty, to make the best use of the information, and now even the possible impact of the forecast. I can even give you an example of warning to fishermen while I was still in Senegal. It was in 2017, where we had one of our worst sea swell. The forecast was some 4-5 meters. We couldn't verify it because of lack of data. But fishermen said they have never seen such waves. So warnings were issued well ahead, some 5-7 days ahead, directly to the network of fishermen via text and voice messages on WhatsApp, posts on social media, and usual TV and radio channels. But believe me, they took heed of the forecasts and warning. None of them went to sea. Instead, they secured their boat and equipment, and we didn't record any single death, unlike before, when there were several deaths for even weaker events. So the dissemination of information and the trust of the users are very important. Therefore, to increase the resilience of society to extreme weather events and make a good uptake of the scientific advances, we need to invest in the capacity to disseminate weather and climate information and on the capacity to receive and use these information by all users, as well as building the trust and confidence of these users.
Thank you, Marianne. Doug, we've already touched on the importance of the academic sector in Africa and other developing countries in training scientific and technical skills and in carrying out weather research relevant to forecasting challenges. I wonder if you have a view on how development partners could help to strengthen academia in developing countries further. Of course, there's a rich tradition of training African meteorologists in universities in developed countries. So I guess a further question is, what does the future look like in this context?
Yeah, thank you. So I do think it's extremely valuable and important to connect the academic and operational sectors in this area. And I think too often funding programs or funding projects tend to sit in one or the other. So perhaps development funding tends to support operational activities that are very much focused on the, rightly, but on the end user, but neglecting the role of academia, whereas research projects focus on academia and neglect the operational partner. So what's really important, I think, is to have funding and development activities that bring both together. Academia does interestingly bring a lot of legacy that people often forget about to practical operational activities, because if you develop some some new methodologies, and that can be in the social science, it can be in the communication and forecast, you know, these two stages which Marianne talked about, the scientific and the delivery side. In both of those, if you get that into the academic program, then it's taught to students year in, year out. You know, generations of students get that, but also the academic staff in the universities and the PhD students will then develop those ideas and take them further. So universities do have an important role to play in the legacy of operational activity. But of course, the operational centres are the ones that really deliver the impact. So there's enormous value in connecting both together. And I, you know, really think that funded programmes should do more of this. My own experience has been really positive, in particular in Ghana, working with KNUST in Ghana, in Kumasi, that's a Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology. We started working with KNUST during the AMA project in 2008, and they set up a new degree programme at that time in meteorology and climate science with some UK support from Leeds and Reading. And that programme has really blossomed over the years, and it's now they have 360 students on their undergraduate program. They have a master's, and they're bringing international students from across Africa into their master's and training within Africa. And because they are a university, they have a research program that taps into international projects. So they've been partners in a number of international projects over the years. So therefore, they have an active research program. They're publishing papers in international journals. And they have a complete career path through from undergraduate through to, you know, to professor, basically, and all the stages in between. So I think it's an example of how the research and teaching interface can provide robust, you know, high quality activity, which then provides this legacy and this important underpinning for the local operational agencies. So you know, this was part of your question, really, is what the future lies in this regard and what the future holds. And I would hope that the future holds more African early career, you know, trainee scientists being trained in their own countries, in partnership with countries overseas. And we mentioned the positive impacts of COVID earlier. We're all learning so much more about how to communicate remotely. And so these partnerships with, say, co-supervision of students and project students are getting much, much easier all the time. As one, you know, final example here, the KNUST in Ghana, in partnership with GMET, the Ghana Meteorological Agency, have just started within SWIFT their own it's a seminar program. They're starting it within Ghana for a trial period, and then they're going to make it international. So in fact, this suddenly becomes blindingly obvious. You know, all academic departments around the world are holding their seminar series quite happily with international seminar series, and learning they can have international speakers from anywhere in the world. And suddenly this becomes obvious for Africa, that strong African academic centres and operational centres can invite the best speakers in the world to come and present in their seminar programmes. And the value of that for knowledge and skills, and keeping African scientists up to date with the international level of progress in the field, could be enormous.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
One of our themes on the WeatherPod is how public and private weather services engage within the weather enterprise and how they contribute to expanding the overall weather market. To date, National Meteorological and Hydrological Services have been quite reluctant to engage with the private sector in Africa. We know that many are concerned that the private sector could undermine their positions as public bodies. Marianne, what are your views on how we can address these concerns, and whether you think we should be encouraging a more open market for weather information?
I think you are right. Somehow, it's true that there is some mistrust between national met services and some of the private sector, I think. And in many cases, it's a matter of competition rather than complementarity. And I believe that issuing warnings is solely the mandate of national authority. The objective is to avoid confusing the end users with multiple messages from several sources, including those with no proven experience. Because sometimes the private sector don't have any experience of the local situation, the local meteorology and climate in that area. I think we can encourage an open market, but this must be regulated. Strong legal framework, particularly the rules of engagement, should be put in place. And these frameworks should provide room for win-win collaboration between the national med services and the private sector in delivering weather and climate information for the benefit of the society.
That's very interesting, Marianne. I'd like to just follow up on that a little. I know that some development partners are working directly with the private sector to harness big data, for example, to develop tools to assist decision-making in various areas for disaster risk reduction, etc. However, quite often this work may not actually involve the National Met Service. Do you think this sort of approach helps or hinders development in the long term?
I'm very much aware of that, yeah. And worse, even I would say some of these private sector would just get hold of the database of the National Met Services in terms of their farmers, the farmers they are using, they're working with, and sell the climate information to farmers. And I think that this is not ethical at all. Both the development partners and the private sector should, I think, work with the National Met Services and capacitate them, if needed, to produce weather and climate services, rather than producing themselves the services and work directly with the local communities. By doing so, I think they're weakening the National Met Services, and in the long term, these National Met Services, these African weak National Met Services, may even disappear. And these so-called development partners and the private sector may no longer be there for the populations, because they came only for the course of projects. After the end of the project, they can go away, and population will be left by themselves and with no National Met Services. So I think that they need to work hand by hand and co-produce information and capacitate eventually the National Met Services.
Thanks, Marianne. To draw our conversation to a conclusion, Doug, I wonder, how do you see the prospects for the public, private and academic sectors interacting so that they might be able to co-produce high-value weather information very much along the lines of what Marianne has just suggested? I'd also like to ask you, could you tell us a bit about the Forecaster Handbook? What is the uptake of that in West Africa?
You know, I would echo the things that Marianne has said. I think there are enormous opportunities, I think, for the private sector to contribute to delivering information to the users. And by typically focusing on a narrow user group, a particular sector, and limiting what they have to do, there's lots of evidence that those companies can work profitably and deliver useful information to the partners. But that last part, to the customers. But that last part is really key. And what's really lacking throughout the tropics is reliable evaluation of a forecast skill and evaluation forecast methods. So in this sense, all users of information are vulnerable to the sales the sales arguments of a given provider. So this comes back to a number of the themes we talked about today, the need for observations locally so that we can actually evaluate whether a commercial product or a free product, a set of competing products, whether we can actually evaluate which of those is performing usefully for our purposes. So I would say that evaluation of forecasts is the primary thing that we need now to make progress in this area, to actually try and get some kind of harmony between these different sectors. Because until we can do that, then we just have a variety of competing products aiming at different sectors, perhaps not overlapping, and people are helpless really in knowing whether any of these are competitive with each other. So the academic sector, of course, has a role to play in that. The intellectual aspect of evaluating forecasts, but also of expanding the scope of what can be done. There are significant numbers of young African graduates with skills in meteorology and climate science, coming into the market, not all going to work in the weather services. And there are lots with entrepreneurial instincts. So there should be possibilities for African companies to emerge, which don't then necessarily withdraw or undermine the infrastructure in the country if they are owned and led within Africa. So I think that would be an interesting direction, as opposed to the current situation, which seems to be bigger companies from outside Africa coming in to deliver offer services, which may run the risk of undermining local capacity. I think, I mentioned before the need for quality as well. I mean, this is related to evaluation, but I think at the moment, I still believe that, I don't think what I said was inconsistent with Marianne's point. I said that the numerical weather prediction forecasts for rainfall in 24 hours are unreliable, they're low quality. Marianne said, well, actually we're doing much better. And I think the connection there, the resolution to that is because the human input into the forecast in Africa is vital, because the numerical weather prediction is weaker. The NWP models, the numerical weather prediction models, do a good job of the large scale circulation. And then human forecasters use that information to infer rainfall. And they are, as they can't do in the north anymore, in Africa, they can still improve the forecast and they can do better than the numerical forecast. So this is to say that you still need these experts, you still need trained forecasters, and the kind of automated systems which I think commercial companies want to put in place will still underperform, I suspect, although we don't know that until we have proper evaluation put in place. So nobody quite knows what the future will bring, but I think it's kind of inevitable that commercial delivery of forecast by the private sector will increase. It will bring benefits to users who will get products more tightly focused on their own needs. It may undermine the local capability, and that's a real problem. But if we can encourage African entrepreneurs to actually take leadership of this, this could be a way for this to be more to be done without undermining local capacity. So you also asked about our book. So that was something which Marion and I led over a number of years. So the book was finally published in 2017. And it's I don't think you'll see it in your local news agent for sale, but we have had a good number of copies sold. The UK and French weather services, Météo France and UK Met Office, both through their development budgets, purchased a number of copies. So in fact, 300 copies, the English and French copies, have been delivered to African weather services and universities. So, and I know from our work in SWIFT that the methods in the book are being used in training. And they're starting to be used in the universities and in the regional training centres of the WMO. So these things take a bit of time to evolve, but I think the book is starting to have an impact. And hopefully this is all part of the need to sort of strengthen the basic scientific knowledge of people within this field, and maintaining that at the international level, which is what we think this book represents.
I wonder, Marianne, did you have anything to add about the success of your forecasting handbook? How does it look to you?
The forecaster's handbook, I think it's been quite appreciated, because this kind of textbook with practical was really missing in the region. And Forecasters really use it as, I would say, their Bible. They have it on their forecasting desk and use it whenever needed. And recently, we just launched the Severe Weather Forecasting Demonstration Project in Central Africa. And forecasters was asking for it, and they really need it. And this needs to be expanded in other parts of in Africa. And coming back to the private sector, and the public sector and academia working together to produce weather information. I think that we have to go towards that direction, and it is really doable working together. And it will be even more profitable to national met services, but it is pressing for governments to provide national met services with legal framework that adequately cater for this public-private partnership. And I would say that the African Ministerial Conference on Meteorology, AMCOMET, has been calling for years, for nearly a decade, for national met services to be provided with such framework and get autonomous. And progress is now being made, and we can hope that this happens in the near future. And even WMO is also encouraging such partnership. And within its reform, it has put a partnership department to assist and provide guidance to national med services to engage within this public-private partnership.
Thank you very much, Marion and Doug, for coming along today. It's been a very illuminating conversation.
Yes, thanks, Marianne and Doug. It's been really good and very valuable, I think, in your enthusiasm and insight into the African situation. So thank you both very much.
Yes, many thanks.
Thanks for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that concludes this episode of the Weather Pod. We hope you've enjoyed it. David and I will be back next month. And in the meantime, please give us your feedback via email. Support at gweforum.org.